Gosh, you're the grandfather. Thank you so much for all these people in this beautiful circle.
I smell so good.
Beautiful people, every one of them, living in such sweetness and sincerity in a time where that's so out of style. Brave hearts all. We come together every Sunday like this to refuel with one another from your infinite source of light and love and energy. I want to invite all of their loved ones, everyone in the circle's loved ones, to join us in spirit today, and all of their loved ones, and all of our ancestors, especially those who watch out for us, protect us and guide us, to come and sit in that honored chair opposite me. Please help me say and do the things that are the most helpful for everyone who's here, with and without their bodies. May everyone have the healings, inner and outer, that they need. The first thing I wanted to talk about today is that there were a lot of questions last week afterwards about the sweat lodge coming up. My friend Paul Ghosthorse, whose father I knew before him, Buck Ghosthorse, who led a Sundance. Oh, is this not working? Okay. So my friend Paul Ghosthorse, whose father Buck led a Sundance for years and years in Oregon, and Paul took over his father's dance when his father crossed over. Well, he's going to be here on November 30th, and I asked Paul if he would like to tour a lodge while he's here, and he said, "Well, let's talk about that in a few weeks, you know, just see what we get." And when I talked to him about it, Julius, he said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, I don't know, you know, that there'll be many people want to come because I haven't bumped into many people around here that are sweating, you know, regularly." And he said, "I don't care if there's just one person and a groundhog."
And we have a groundhog here.
Plenty of those. So that made me feel good. So we're going to have a lodge with a Sundance chief who is very balanced. When you meet Paul, you're going to meet a person who is just like so calm and steady and thoughtful in all of his words and actions. And he said it would be a purification lodge. So we're going to purify our bodies with sweating and our minds and hearts with prayer, you know, and song. And it'll be in Barbara and Lou Vitale's place where I live. I rent from them. Thank you. And there were questions, which are understandable, of course, in that kind of situation. This needs to be held or set on something so that it burns the floor if it heats up. It's not going to get that hot, but whatever. Thank you. A week from this coming Saturday will be a day that we will be building the lodge. Anyone who wants to come help build a lodge is, of course, welcome. And we'll start about 10 in the morning, we'll say, 2 weeks from yesterday. And I'll gather the saplings before that and have them soaking in the lake in front of my house for a week or so. So they'll be nice and flexible, you know, for building the lodge. And we'll be tying those together, making the dome in the traditional way. And the dome, of course, is just the top half of the lodge. You know, it's under the ground too. It's a sphere that we're in. It's a womb of the Mother Earth. And we're going to take these ancient rocks, the Thukan, and heat them up in the fire and turn them into Eon, the spirit-filled rocks. You know, they come from billions of years ago. They've been cold for billions of years, and they're going to come, and we're going to make them red hot again in the fire, like they were when they were born. And then they're going to take us back in that womb. And we're going to come out of there all wet and be reborn. We'll crawl out of there on our hands and knees. You can leave anytime you need in the lodge, but most people come out when the doors open between rounds. There's four rounds. There's usually seven rocks brought in with each round. And a lot of people get hung up about the temperature. It is warmer than your average sauna. Though I have been in lodges that were just barely that warm. Never can tell ahead of time how spirit's going to make it. I've been in lodges where it was very oppressive and intense, the heat. Most new people find it real intense, but I tell them, now, do your slow, deep belly breathing. Relax. Stop resisting. The men need that heat to humble, be humbled. The women don't need it. They walk with Grandmother Moon. They dance with her. They stay in touch with the earth more than the average man. The men need that heat for that humbling, so our hearts can open. Women usually wear a long skirt or one piece, you know, down like that. Usually just put it on over the shorts right before we go in. Well, you put it on when you come into the circle near the fire. And it's all about prayer. You don't come to a ceremony to see what it's like. You come because you've got something you need to pray about. You don't come to make friends. If a man asks a woman for her phone number, he'll be asked to leave. That's not what it's about. It'd be different, really, if a woman asked a man for his phone number, actually, now that I think about it. The women and children and old ones, you know, are the most respected just by their natural connection. So I'll take two questions if anybody has a question about the sweat lodge before we move into the topic for the day. Yeah.
I'd like to help, but I don't know where they live.
You don't know what?
I don't know where they live.
Okay. Well, you go about 441 south. And I'll send you directions, you know. Yeah, it's just about 4 miles south of Franklin on 441. Off 441. Yeah.
What's the diameter?
I've seen lodges as large as the circle we're in. At the first Sundance, I was the firekeeper for the AIM, American Indian Movement Sundance in 1996 at Pipestone. They had four lodges almost as big as the circle. 65 dances. And my first Sundance, and they made me the firekeeper, the head firekeeper. They made me the head firekeeper for the whole AIM Sundance with 65 dancers and 1,000 Lakota Ojibwe supporters there, and every elder you ever heard of. And the spiritual leader in charge said, "You be the firekeeper." That was quite an experience. I'll tell that story sometime.
How large will you be building this lodge?
I'm sorry, it was the two questions. You don't get to ask a question. No, this lodge will be about half the size of this circle. Room for easy 15 people. You know, we can make two rows if we need to of people in the lodge. Yeah, good question. Any other questions you might have, I'll ask you to call me or text me is better, really. And I think everybody's got that list of them. Membership, or ask me after this is over with today. Okay? All right. So the first story I'm going to tell two stories today. And the first one is about in graduate school, my best friend was dating a woman who had a child, a five-year-old girl. And this little girl was not like any five-year-old girl I had ever seen at the time. I've seen one since then that was like her. And I was over there with him. You know, he's my best friend. And, you know, I was over at this house where this woman lives that he's dating, you know, maybe a total of seven times in a year. And the first two or three times I was over there, this little girl would walk in, and she would look around at us sitting in the room, you know, those shoes look like you got them at Walmart about 5 years ago, you know, and you need to lose some weight. I mean, have you looked in a mirror lately? And, I mean, can't you do anything better with your hair than that? And then she would just walk out of the room. She did that 2 or 3 times, you know. And the second or third time, after she walked out of the room, you know, I said, yeah, it was 3 times, I remember now. Yeah, it was the third time. She walked out of the room, you know, and I turned to her mother and I said, I'm sorry, you know, no offense or anything, but that's the third time your daughter's addressed us like that, you know, and then left the room. I'm just real curious, what's the deal with her, you know? And she wore these little old lady horn-rimmed glasses, you know, points on the sides, you know, narrow little glasses, 5 years old, you know. I said, well, what's the deal with that? And the woman went, oh, God, I hate to say it, you know, but I was pregnant with her when my mother died. And she told me she was going to come back as that baby in my belly and torment me the way I tormented her as a child. And I didn't really take that threat seriously until a month ago we went to get her glasses. And she had a whole wall of frames to choose from, and she chose my mother's glasses.
Wow. I love it.
Yeah. So, I kind of did I still have mixed feelings about this. I was trying to be funny and at the same time call attention to some things, you know. The girl's birthday was coming. And we lived in a 2-room shack with carpet laying on dirt for a floor. And the rent was $85 a month. We had our first child in that shack. And half the time I didn't have the $85. I mowed yards after school each day when the weather allowed. And there was, in the kitchen, we had a cat and we had it was my first cat, and I was, you know, a lot of people leave food out for the cat abundance, you know, and so I was leaving good cat food out overnight in there, you know, and then, like I said, the floor had rotted out in most of the house, well, at least half the house, the floor totally rotted out, and I didn't know until one night I went in to get a drink of water in the middle of the night and felt something squish between my toes. I turned the light on, and there were these giant slugs in there eating that cat food, you know, coming out from under the house, and I was eating the cat food and going in it after the sun came up, I guess. And so I gave her I gave that girl one of those giant slugs for a birthday present. I'm kind of embarrassed to say, but it just seemed appropriate, you know.
What was her response?
You know, I think she thought it was cool. That's what I was hoping she would do. You know, I think that was a really cool present, you know. A pet slug, you don't get any of those. Remind me of those banana slugs in Oregon, you know. But it was just a regular. Pardon?
The slugs was the school mascot in Santa Cruz.
That's true, yeah.
Slime was the runners.
The runners on the team are kind of slow. Okay, so that's the first, quote, personal story about reincarnation that was certainly kind of hard to explain any other way. You know, some pretty valid, you know. My wife and I would run 5 miles a day out in the country, you know, for a few years, you know, after we got together. And we would often run a new route, you know, get bored of the same old route. And one day we were running along and we were on a new route we'd never been on before. And there was a real nice brick house out in the country with a swimming pool, in-ground swimming pool. And out came this beautiful dog that looked to be like 3/4 Irish Setter and 1/4 Golden Retriever. It had the sleek body of the Irish Setter, but a little lighter colored coat, more like a Golden Retriever. And she came up to us and just joyfully bounced around, you know, and I squatted down to pet it, you know, and I was shocked when I touched it because there was no place on its body you could put your thumb like that without touching a tick. And You know how Irish setters have that long fur on their chest and on the backs of their legs? Those five places were just full of those great big grass burrs, you know, the real pointy ones. And they were digging sores into her skin, you know, like bleeding sores, you know. And the next day, we went that same route, and she followed us home. And I put her in her old VW bug and took her back to the house. You know, I knocked on the door and said, "I just want to let you know I brought your dog back." And they kicked her and cussed at her. And I was saying, "No, I'm not bothered by it. The dog just followed me home on my run, you know, and in case you were missing her, you know, I wanted you to know I'm bringing her back." And, you know, they were really abusive to her. The next day, she followed us home again, and the same thing was repeated when I brought her back. So the third day she followed us home, she stayed. And I went to Walmart and bought dip, you know, and got all those fleas and ticks off of her, and I got the scissors and cut all those burrs out of her legs and put betadine on her wounds, and she was so happy, you know. It was just unbelievable how happy she was. So we named her Happy Girl. And dogs were not allowed on campus, which was just across the street from the little shack we lived in. It was East Texas State University where I got my doctorate. And Happy Girl was allowed. I loved her so much. And she would be as close to me as she could get on the outside of the building. You know, wherever I was in class, you know, I could go out and look out the window, she'd be right there, close as she could get to me, you know. And one time I tested her. I went in this long building, about 60 or 70 yard long building, you know, with classrooms on each side. You know, she went straight in one door and out the door at the other end. She came right around the corner, you know. Came out the other end. I have to confess, in those days, I was a little wilder than I am now. I sometimes slept with her in the yard. She was an outside dog. My dad never allowed, well, one time he let one pet in the house a few times, but dogs were off limits, you know, in the house. And so I, you know, this was my first dog. It was just mine, and I, you know, didn't know any better. And so she stayed outside. Slugs might have got her if it brought her in anyway. But she was just so beautiful and loving and so happy, always smiling. You know, everybody loved her, and nobody questioned her being on campus, and knew everybody, you know. And then we finished school there, and she rode me in the U-Haul to my first, well, I taught at East Texas as a teaching assistant, you know, while I was a grad student. So that was really my first teaching job. My second college teaching job was at Columbia College in Columbia, Missouri. And she rode in the U-Haul with me there, you know. And that was close to, we had a place out in the country, but there was a golf course nearby. And I would often run on that golf course, you know. And she would run along with me. She just loved running, you know, with me. No matter how long it was to run, she would run with me and run twice as far as I did. Even a 10-mile run, she would just be going all over the place on the road. And then I was there 2 years and got then the great job at Valdosta State University in Valdosta, Georgia, a tenure track position there. And we got a nice house on a 400-acre lake, and it was exactly 5 miles around the lake. So I would run around that lake Monday through Friday, you know, in the morning, and Happy Girl would run with me, and we would have a great time. And it was a great place for her, you know. She liked to swim, and all the kids, you know, swimming on right off the back of the house, off the deck, you know, and dock. And I noticed that Happy Girl started not running so much, you know. She would just like a little bit more than me, and then pretty soon she was just running beside me. And then she started having trouble keeping up, you know. And so I took her to a vet, you know, and I couldn't find anything wrong with her, you know. Then I noticed some blood in her poop, and I took her to another vet, and he couldn't find anything wrong with her. In retrospect, it was probably colon cancer, I would guess, you know. And she gradually got to where she didn't go running with me. And she was laying on the back porch in the sun one morning, and I noticed that she like was stiffening up, you know. And I knew that she wouldn't be there when I got home that evening. And I told her, you know, I don't know how this works, but maybe you could come back as the little baby in Kara's belly, you know. She was about 3 months pregnant. And I said, I don't know how that stuff works, you know, but maybe you could. I don't know. If you can, we'd sure love to have you. And I buried her that evening by the garden. Roll forward 3 years later, after we had our third child with no medical help. I don't recommend that. We were a little too wild, baby, back there. To unnecessary risk. But it was a beautiful birth. We had two boys, and then she would have her little girl, Sierra Dawn. And when she was three, she was out in the garden with me, you know. She was like three and a half. And this dog came swimming by. It looked like Happy Girl, just swimming by, you know. You don't see that very often. They're usually out walking, you know. This dog was getting his morning lap or something. You know? They love water. And there it was, swimming by, you know. About a minute after it swam by, I said, Sierra, can you remember what you were doing or what you looked like before you came into this body? She said, yeah, Daddy. I said, what did you look like? She said, I look like that puppy that just swam by. I said, really? She said, yeah, don't you remember, Daddy? You and Mommy both told me I could come back as the little baby in her belly the day I died. I was Happy Girl, don't you remember? Yeah. That afternoon, I saw Kara. I said, did you tell Happy Girl she could come back as a baby in her belly, in your belly the day she died? She said, yeah, how did you know? I said, she told me today. So you see what I mean, right? That removed all doubt. That reincarnation, yeah, completely removed all doubt. And left no room for any other explanation. 3-year-olds don't pretend about stuff like that. So, like Kim says, we come and we go, 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 we come and we go. But it seems like when we're here, that it's so, so huge. We're told we just have one lifetime, right? How many times have you heard that? Don't screw it up. You only get one lifetime. How many times did I hear that growing up?
The only one.
Yeah. You're going to burn forever if you don't do it right. What do you mean? I've seen children brought to me in my private practice with deathly fears. They're there because they're afraid of burning forever, to seek me, you know, for help. The stories they've been told. I'll never forget one time a boy was brought to see me when he was 7. And he was having all kind of problems. And during the background interview, his mother and her mother were there for the background interview to start with, you know. And everything was just perfectly normal. Nothing out of the ordinary at all, you know. And this kid's having all kind of problems, you know. Social skill problems, you know, low self-esteem, academic underachievement, and so forth. And they're on the way out the door. When the grandmother says to her daughter, don't you think we ought to tell him? When I heard that, I was like, well, come back and sit down, you know. What were you referring to, you know? And she says, go ahead, tell him, you know. And the mother says, well, when he was 3, we had a swimming pool, and a boy down the street came over to play with him at the pool, you know, and I looked out there, and they had their pants down, and were looking at each other's private. I said, and how did you respond to that? She said, well, I beat him and shunned him. And I said, I'm not exactly sure what you mean by that. You know, what do you mean you beat him and shunned him? Well, I beat him black and blue, and ever since then, when he wants a hug, we turn our back on him.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So, religion can lead people in some really amazing choices. Sometimes turning their back on their own children, 3-year-old, and then wonder why he's having problems. And so, through some very beautiful spirit guides, we all are so privileged to be sitting in this circle today with our eyes and hearts and minds wide open. Yeah. So we don't stop and thank those helpers enough, you know. Imagine if you had a dozen people that you were responsible for helping guide and protect from the spirit worlds into the physical. And one of them was always talking to you and listening and watching for your signs and guidance and all. All the others were oblivious to your presence. Which one would you help the most? Duh. Right? So we have to cultivate a relationship with them. Just like you cultivate a friendship. They're right there all the time. And not just a few. I had this, I'll tell you the story how I was got to experience that firsthand. Before this day, I always thought that talk about your grandmothers watching over you at home was just kind of a metaphor, you know, not literally your grandmother, yeah. And I was at my very first elders gathering. And the way I got there was, I was at a psychology conference in Atlanta where we were gathering to talk about ways to resist the managed care takeover of our business, where they would be telling us what to do and how to do it all, you know. And so this started off with a big meal in a big ballroom in a huge hotel downtown Atlanta with like 50 tables with 7 or 8 people sitting around each table. And I noticed in the middle of the room were these two ladies looking rather nervous and agitated, having a conversation, wringing their hands like, what do we do? And Spirit said, go offer to play your flute. Here? Yeah, okay. So I walk up there and said, I just want you to know I've been playing the Native American flute since 1976, and I have one in my truck, you know, and if sometime this weekend you'd like me to play for a meditation or whatever, you know, I'd be happy to do that. And they said, oh, they grabbed me, you know, oh, you're a savior here. You know, we were just talking about if we have a prayer before the meal, some people would be offended. If we don't, some people would be offended, you know, but everybody would love the flute. Go get it, please. Thank you, you know. And they introduced me as a Native American. Did I tell this story before? Okay. So they introduced me as a Native American. I told them, you know, both my grandmother's mothers were said to be Native American, but the Trail of Tears wiped out all the records and all, so nobody knows for sure. But I have heard a lot of stories from them, and I still have one of my grandma's braids, my mom's mom's long, long braids down in here. Anyway, so I played for a while, and then I was thinking about Chief Joseph, the chief of the Nez Perce, that the army could never capture him and his people. He beat them by evading them for many months in the Northwest. And so I just played for a while, and then I said, I leaned over the microphone, I said, remember, there's a Chief Joseph in each of us. Didn't dawn on me until the next day that nobody ever had any idea what I was talking about. Maybe they looked it up. Then I played for a little longer. And then after I played and was done, out of this crowd of psychologists walks this Native American grandmother in full regalia, buckskin dress, you know. She walks up and says, Sio, Siwaja. I said, what? She says, Sio, Siwaja. I said, I'm sorry, I don't speak that language. He said, well, you said you're Native American. I said, well, both my grandmother's mothers were said to be Native American, but I don't speak a language. She said, oh, but do you know about the gathering in Vermont next month? Gathering in Vermont? Don't know anything about a gathering in Vermont, yeah. You got to realize, this was like 1990, 1988. And I had been playing the flute for 12 years by then, the native flute. And I had no idea that they had elders gatherings and traditional ceremonies, you know. And she said, well, here's my card. I'm Pond Lily. If you're interested in coming to the gathering in Vermont, call me. We'll talk about it. I said, okay, thank you. I'll call you. You know, so I call her, and she tells me about this grandmother's gathering out in the middle of nowhere in Vermont. She says, now, are you on the Red Road? And I said, no, I'm not on the Red Road. She said, what do you mean? I said, I was a Baptist. Then I went to the Unitarian Universalist for a while, tried to figure out what I wanted to be after that. And then I was in Eckankar for 21 years and became a high initiate in Eckankar and found one tiny little dishonest thing about that and bailed on that. And then I just been, you know, playing this flute and being with nature, you know, ever since then. So you're on the Red Road. No, I'm not on the Red Road. I'm not on anybody's road. I'm on my road. You know, I'm on the path of my own heart. I'm not going to follow anybody else's road for the rest of this lifetime. She said, well, after about seven or eight times back and forth like that, she said, the Red Road is the path of your own heart. And I said, oh, okay, well, I'm on the Red Road. She said, okay, so you can come. And so I get there after dark. And it was hard to find. It was really out in the middle of nowhere in rural Vermont. I flew to, I think it was Nashua, New Hampshire from Atlanta and drove over and followed these instructions. It was before GPS, so, you know, I didn't have one anyway. And I had a rental car just out there trying to find it, you know. And finally, I find what it looks like a parking lot out there in the wilderness with 30 or 40 cars in it. So I park, and it's misting rain like it so often does in the Appalachians, you know, just like it does here. This is the northern end, you know, the Appalachians, and it was like 10 p.m. and I forgot to bring a flashlight. You know, I'm setting up my tent in this misting rain, you know, crawl in and go to sleep, you know. And I wake up. I didn't have a watch either. I wake up, and it's still misting rain. And I think I hear singing in the distance, still pitch black, no moon, and I hear singing in the distance. I definitely am hearing some singing a long ways away, but I can hear just a little bit of singing every now and then, you know. So I get up, I get dressed, and I just start walking through the forest, following my weak ears, because I think this was before I had hearing aids, and I go through the forest looking for the source of the singing, you know, in this misty rain and complete pitch blackness. And about 150 yards away or so, you know, I come upon this little pavilion with about six picnic tables under the roof, you know. And this beautiful but old grandmother is talking to a group of about, I'd say 15 people, maybe something like that. And as I walk up, she says, I'd like to welcome all you volunteers. You know, thank you for being here for the volunteer meeting. So we're going to have a table here for security. Who wants to be on the security team? And there were about four, you know, big guys, you know. Step. We want to be on the security. She said, okay, we'll come over by this table. I'm going to tell you how we do security here. You're to walk around, you're like covert, so nobody's going to know you're here for security. Okay? You are to put out so much love and humility that nothing negative could possibly enter this space. Yeah. So that's what we do for security here. And you guys are going to be in charge of that. What a beautiful way. Come that masculine energy down, what a burden to carry. And so, and this will be for the people who are going to work with the children over here. So, of course, I'm Andrew over there, and kitchen staff, and y'all sit, I'm going to sit at this table, and can't remember what the other two or three others. And so she says, before we start, though, I'm going to sing a song to invite our grandmothers to help us, you know, with this this meeting and this weekend. Well, it was 4 days, you know. And she started singing this song in her tongue, you know. She was from northern Canada out west. And she started singing this song, and I closed my eyes. And she said, be sure to invite your grandmothers in, too. You know, like I tell you that when I'm speaking, you know. I forgot to mention that earlier. That's the chair for, I mentioned for your ancestors, but you got to invite them in, see. There's a law of non-interference between planets and between dimensions. And so we got to invite them for their help. Don't forget that. So I close my eyes and say, hey, Grandma Bush, Grandma Lisa, I love you. You know, you can come here with me, you know, help me this weekend. I do like you say. You know, she's just like 7 feet away from me singing this beautiful song, you know. And all of a sudden, I thought about their mothers, you know, and their grandmothers. And I said, yeah, all of y'all, and all my helpers, and y'all are welcome to join. You know, my two grandmothers were right there on either side of me, just like that, as soon as I acknowledged them. And this, just as clearly present as you are. And all of a sudden, I was surrounded by like 15 middle-aged women who all seemed so familiar. And they're all of them. In that instant, I realized it's not just a sweet metaphor. It's literal. Now, granted, some people's grandmothers had such issues, they had to come back. They had a lot more to learn. But go back far enough, you know, there's some loving grandmother there taking care of her great-great-granddaughter, you know. And they don't look old anymore. Or at least mine did. It makes so much sense, doesn't it? That a total stranger being assigned to us is our spirit guide, helping protect him. Sure, someone we already have a relationship with. I'm reminded of, I'm going to stay with that first story about that first elder's getting to tell you a little bit more about that. I must have cried a gallon of tears in that 4 days. Imagine being so into it like I was, having nature been my source of rescue in all those years. That's how my older sister taught me to avoid dad's abuse, which is to stay away from home and be invisible when you're home. So I spent a lot of time fishing, hunting, and just roaming the woods, you know, especially at grandma's farm out in the middle of nowhere. And at this gathering, there were just so many special moments. One was perhaps the highlight of the whole. I had my first sweat lodge there with Grandfather Eagle, who lived above the Arctic Circle in his native tongue. I had my first sweat lodge experience. And there was a morning when the head grandmother was to address everybody. They had a great big arbor and a fire in the middle, you know, and everybody entered through the east gate, and in the west, the elders and mainly grandmothers sat. And because I was so close to my grandmothers growing up, to this day, I hang with the grandmothers. You know, that's where I feel like I fit in. I'm more like them than any other group there. And so I was hanging out with them in the west. And it was the coming of age ceremony for the girls who had started having their moon time, their cycles, you know, in the previous year. And I noticed these young girls making these buckskin dresses the whole 4 days, you know, this was the last day. And so the sun was not quite behind the horizon to the west behind me and the grandmothers when it was time for the girls to come in through the east gate. And on the mountain behind them was a little, one of those misty showers, you know, coming down. And just as they entered the east gate, a double rainbow appeared over the gate as they came in. And as they came in and started dancing around the fire, about a dozen butterflies and dragonflies came in and danced with them. And several of them had 3 or 4 year old sisters, little sisters who just couldn't help themselves and had to come out and dance with their big sister. And at ceremony, the children can do no wrong. When you go to ceremonies, you'll see people with handicaps that otherwise wouldn't be out in public, that everybody knows, you know, they're welcome. And they're often thought of as messenger carriers, you know, say things that others wouldn't. I remember one time I was standing kind of stiff like this, kind of intimidated, in a feed store, you know. And the local funny guy that rode the funny bicycle everywhere, you know, walks up to me and he stands beside me, he sticks his chest out and he looks over, he's imitating me, you know. And I got the message, you know. Relax. Quit trying to look tough in the feed store. And so that was such a beautiful ceremony. After dancing around the fire 4 times, I guess it was, and everybody standing up under the arbor like this with both arms up, you know, sending them love and blessings. They lined up in front of the grandmothers, you know. And one by one, the grandmothers took the microphone, you know. They said things like, okay, boys, everybody, all you boys, listen up. These are women now. They're life givers. They're not your sister anymore. They're not your buddy. You don't speak to them unless they speak to you first. I don't care if it's your own sister and you're sitting at the dining table and the potatoes are in front of her and you want them. You don't say, sis, would you pass the potatoes? You say, Mom, I wonder if my sweet sister would be willing to pass the potatoes. And girls, if any boys come up and start talking to you, you know they don't have enough respect and you don't want nothing to do with them. Can you imagine how far we've come from that matriarchal honoring from the Mother Earth to the new mother? Another marvelous thing was one morning the head grandmother was supposed to come talk and she had to go do a healing ceremony for somebody nearby who really needed it. She wasn't going to be there for an hour. And the grandmother's right beside me, her going, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Like, everybody's here now, you know, for her talk and she's not going to be here for an hour. I said, I brought some flutes. And they're like, oh, great, go get your flutes. You know, I have about 6 flutes with me. And I have to play for everybody for an hour. You know? And it was so wonderful because people were coming in and they would go to the fire and put down their tobacco, you know, and they had cornmeal if you wanted. If it was in your tradition for them, cornmeal in the fire, make their prayer, and then go to their seat, you know. And I'm playing the flute for an hour. And I look over at the grandmother beside me and she's got tears coming down her cheeks. Oh. So that was just my first ceremony. About 1987. And boy, I was just so moved because that brought back so much past life. When I was like 5 or 6, I remember telling my mom I was having these dreams of sitting in a cone shaped house and people coming in and talking with me. And I was smoking this long pipe with them and they were talking to me and then they would leave feeling a lot better. And so all this, what seems like magic that's actually just natural, is all around us all the time. And we've just been brought up in a culture that numbs us to it. And it's just right there. Like, look at that smile. That's magic right there. You know, that I How did you sleep like that? And so it's just so much beauty around us, just waiting to be enjoyed. We're at a feast, you know, satisfied with potato chips, you know. So I guess I'm supposed to stop at 12, right? So I think I better wrap it up about there. But it's always a beautiful blessing and honor to speak to such good people that are so receptive and can get where I'm coming from. It opens my heart, you know, to have such a receptive group to talk to. One last thing that hit me the other day is sometimes people don't believe my story, and it used to hurt my feelings, you know. And then about 8 months ago, it dawned on me, wait a minute, that's kind of stupid. You're telling the story because it's unbelievable. You can't take offense because people don't believe it, you know. okay, all right. Well, thank you all so much.
Thank you.